the worst possible news. Mama, who had given us grave cause for concern, has died. I am beside myself with grief.
Young Victoria by Juliet Ace starred Imogen Stubbs, Anna Massey, Adrian Lucas, Selena Cadell, John Rowe, Christopher Cazenove, Andrew Wincott, Terence Edmund, Thomas Arnold, Claire Corbett and George Allenby. It was produced by Cherry Cookson. And at the same time tomorrow, whilst Victoria mourns for her mother, Albert will be tormented by Bertie.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
To New York now as we continue Patti Smith's memoir of Manhattan life in the late 60s and 70s. Just Kids.
Boy was in the hallway drinking a glass of tea. From the other end of the hallway...
Lenny Kaye and I would spend both of our December birthdays and New Year's Eve merging poetry and rock and roll. It was our first extended job, a six-day stint, two sets a night and three on the weekends. Through broken strings and a sometimes hostile crowd, we prevailed with the support of a colorful cast of friends. Allen Ginsberg, Robert, Sam Wagstaff, Todd Rundgren and B.B. Buell, Danny Fields and Steve Paul. By New Year's Eve, we were ready for anything. Several minutes after midnight, Lenny and I were performing on the stage of Max's Kansas City. The people were raucous, divided, the electricity in the air tangible. It was the first hour of the new year, and as I looked out into the crowd, I remembered what my mother always said. I turned to Lenny, "So is today, the rest of the year." I took the microphone. He struck the chord. "You should sing more songs," Robert would say when I sang him Pia for one of the old songs we both liked. Lenny and I had a few songs and were developing a repertoire, but we felt confined. We envisioned using the poems to segue into a rhythmic pattern we could both riff on. Although we had yet to find the right person, we thought a piano would suit our style, being both percussive and melodic. Jane Friedman gave us one of the small rooms on the floor she rented above the Victoria Theater on 45th Street and Broadway. There was an old upright piano, and on St. Joseph's Day, we invited a few keyboard players to see if we could find the third man. All the players were talented, but didn't fit in with our idiosyncratic ways. The best, as scripture says, was saved for last. Richard Soule walked in the room wearing a striped boatneck shirt, rumpled linen trousers, his face half concealed behind a mane of golden curls. His beauty and laconic manner did not betray the fact that he was a gifted pianist. As he readied himself at the piano, Lenny and I looked at each other, thinking the same thing. His presence brought to mind the character of Tadzio in Death in Venice. "What do you want?" he asked casually, and proceeded to play a medley that went from Mendelssohn to Marvin Gaye to MacArthur Park. Richard Soule was 19, classically trained, yet he possessed the simplicity of a truly confident musician who did not need to show off his knowledge. He was as happy playing a repetitive three-chord sequence as a Beethoven sonata. With Richard, we were able to move seamlessly between improvisation and song. He was intuitive and inventive, able to give us a field upon which Lenny and I had the freedom to explore in a language of our own. We dubbed it Three Chords Merged with the Power of the Word. The Patty Hearst kidnapping dominated the news that spring. She had been abducted from her Berkeley apartment by an urban guerrilla group tagged the Symbionese Liberation Army. I found myself drawn to this story, partially due to my mother's fixation on the Lindbergh kidnapping and consequent fear of her children being snatched. The images of the grief-stricken aviator and the blood-stained pajamas of his golden-haired son haunted my mother throughout her life. On April 15th, Patty Hearst was caught on a security camera wielding a gun, joining her captors in robbing a San Francisco bank. Subsequently, a tape was released, in which she declared allegiance to the SLA and issued this statement. Tell everybody that I feel free and strong, and I send my greetings and love to all the sisters and brothers out there. Something in these words, magnified by our shared first name, drew me to respond to her complicated plight. Lenny Richard and I merged my meditation on her situation with Jimi Hendrix's version of Hey Joe. The connection between Patty Hearst and Hey Joe lay within the lyrics, a fugitive crying out, I feel so free. We had been thinking of doing a single to see how the effect we were having live could be translated to a record. Lenny was knowledgeable in producing and pressing a single, and when Robert offered to put up the money, we booked time at Jimi Hendrix's studio, Electric Lady. In homage to Jimmy, we decided to record Hey Joe. Wishing to add a guitar line that could represent the desperate desire to be free, we chose Tom Verlaine to join us. We recorded in Studio B with a small 8-track setup in the back of Electric Lady. Before we started, I whispered, Hi, Jimmy, into the microphone. After a false start or two, Richard and Lenny and I, playing together, got our take, and Tom overdubbed 2 tracks of a solo guitar. Lenny mixed these 2 into 1 spiraling lead and then added a bass drum. It was our first use of percussion. Robert, our executive producer, came by and watched anxiously from the control room. He gave Lenny a silver skull ring to commemorate the occasion. At the end of recording Hey Joe, we had 15 minutes left. I decided to attempt Piss Factory. I had written it as a personal anthem of extricating myself from the tedium of being a factory girl, escaping to New York City. Lenny improvised over Richard's soundtrack, and I riffed off the poem. We got our take at exactly midnight. Robert and I stood in front of one of the space alien murals that lined the hall of Electric Lady. He seemed more than satisfied, but could not resist pouting just a little. Patty, he said, you didn't make anything we could dance to. I said I'd leave that to the Marvelettes. Lenny and I designed the record and called our label Mare. We pressed 1,500 copies at a small plant on Ridge Avenue in Philadelphia and distributed them to book and record stores where they sold for $2 apiece. Jane Friedman could also be found at the entrance to our shows, selling them from a shopping bag. Of all the places, our greatest source of pride was to hear it on the Max's jukebox. We were surprised to discover that our B-side, Piss Factory, was more popular than Hey Joe, inspiring us to focus more on our own work. Poetry would still be my guiding principle, but I had it in my mind to one day give Robert his wish. On September 2nd, 1975, I opened the doors of Electric Lady Studio. I walked into Studio A. John Cale, our producer, was at the helm, and Lenny, Richard, Ivan Krall and J.D. Daugherty were inside the recording room setting up their equipment. For the next 5 weeks, we recorded and mixed my first album, Horses. Jimi Hendrix never came back to create his new musical language, but he left behind a studio that resonated all his hopes for the future of our cultural voice. These things were in my mind from the first moment I entered the vocal booth. The gratitude I had for rock and roll as it pulled me through a difficult adolescence. The joy I experienced when I danced. The moral power I gleaned in taking responsibility for one's actions. There was never any question that Robert would take the portrait for the cover of Horses, my oral sword sheathed with Robert's image. I had no sense of how it would look, just that it should be true. The only thing I promised Robert was that I would wear a clean shirt with no stains on it. I went to the Salvation Army on the Bowery and bought a stack of white shirts. Some were too big for me, but the one I really liked was neatly pressed with a monogram below the breast pocket. It reminded me of a Brassi shot of Jean Genet wearing a white monogram shirt with rolled-up sleeves. There was an RV stitched on my shirt. I imagined it belonged to Roger Vadim, who had directed Barbarella. I cut the cuffs off the sleeve to wear under my black jacket, adorned with a horse pin that Alan Lanier had given me. Robert wanted to shoot it at Sam Wagstaff's, since his 15th Avenue penthouse was bathed in natural light. The corner window cast a shadow, creating a triangle of light, and Robert wanted to use it in the photograph. I rolled out of bed and noticed it was late. I raced through my morning ritual, going around the corner to the Moroccan bakery, grabbing a crusty roll, a sprig of fresh mint, and some anchovies. I came back and boiled water, stuffed the pot with mint. I poured olive oil in the open roll, rinsed the anchovies and laid them inside, sprinkling in some cayenne pepper. I poured a glass of tea and thought better of wearing my shirt, knowing that I'd get olive oil on the front of it. Robert came to fetch me. He was worried because it was very overcast. I finished getting dressed, black peg pants, white Lazelle socks, black capizios. I added my favorite ribbon, and Robert brushed the crumbs off my black jacket. We hit the street. He was hungry, and he refused to eat my anchovy sandwiches, so we ended up having grits and eggs at the Pink Teacup. Somehow the day slipped away. It was cloudy and dark, and Robert kept watching for the sun. Finally, in late afternoon, it started to clear. We crossed Washington Square just as the sky threatened to darken again. Robert became worried that we were going to miss the light, and we ran the rest of the way to 15th Avenue. The light was already fading. He had no assistant. We never talked about what we would do or what it would look like. He would shoot it, I would be shot. I had my look in mind, he had his light in mind, that is all. Sam's apartment was Spartan, all white and nearly empty, with a tall avocado tree by the window overlooking 5th Avenue. There was a massive prism that refracted the light, breaking it into rainbows, cascading on the wall across from a white radiator. Robert placed me by the triangle. His hands trembled slightly as he readied to shoot. I stood. The clouds kept moving back and forth. Something happened with his light meter, and he became slightly agitated. He took a few shots. He abandoned the light meter. A cloud went by and the triangle disappeared. He said, "You know, I really like the whiteness of the shirt. Can you take the jacket off?" I flung my jacket over my shoulder, Frank Sinatra style. I was full of references. He was full of light and shadow. "It's back," he said. He took a few more shots. I got it. "How do you know?" "I just know." He took 12 pictures that day. Within a few days, he showed me the contact sheet. "This one has the magic," he said. "When I look at it now, I never see me. I see us." One late afternoon, we were walking down 8th Street when we heard Because of the Night blasting from one storefront after another. It was my collaboration with Bruce Springsteen, the single from the album Easter. Robert was our first listener after we had recorded the song. I had a reason for that. It was what he always wanted for me. In the summer of 1978, it rose to number 13 on the top 40 chart, fulfilling Robert's dream that I would one day have a hit record. Robert was smiling and walking in rhythm with the song. He took out a cigarette and lit it. We had been through a lot since he first rescued me from the science fiction writer and shared an egg cream on a stoop near Tompkins Square. Robert was unabashedly proud of my success. What he wanted for himself, he wanted for us both. He exhaled a perfect stream of smoke and spoke in a tone he only used with me, a bemused scolding, admiration without envy, our brother-sister language. "Patty," he drawled, "you got famous before me."
A And tomorrow, in 1986, Patty will hear bad news about Robert when she continues to read Just Kids at the same time here on Radio 4.